Picture a 71-year-old man in the White House residence eating three Musketeers bars in bed at midnight, calling the same television host for reassurance. Again, this isn't the image we typically associate with presidential power, yet it captures something essential about Trump's second year in office. After Michael Wolff's first book pulled back the curtain on a chaotic first year, Siege reveals something perhaps more unsettling. A president simultaneously under investigation, increasingly isolated, yet somehow maintaining an unshakable belief in his own invincibility. Even if it's bad, it's great, his lawyer told Steve Bannon about Trump's mindset, a philosophy that would be tested as Robert Mueller's investigation tightened its grip. What does it look like when the most powerful office in the world becomes a prison of its own making? Where is my fucking letter? Trump demanded repeatedly, desperate for written confirmation he wasn't Mueller's target. But inside the White House, everyone knew the truth. Nearly every senior staffer had retained lawyers. Steve Bannon alone spent $2 million in legal fees. Staff avoided meetings to prevent becoming witnesses. They trusted no one, knowing colleagues might flip to save themselves. The Mueller grand jury met Thursdays and Fridays, listening with what witnesses called scary attention. Hope Hicks embodied this precarious existence. At 29, Trump's communications director and ultimate secret keeper, she had admitted to the House Intelligence Committee about telling white lies for the president, a confession requiring emergency legal consultation. Trump valued her not for political acumen, but for pliant dutifulness, calling her Hopi, while simultaneously making her the subject of prurient speculation. When she abruptly resigned in February 2018, alarm bells rang. Had she cut a deal? She'd been on Air Force One when they crafted a largely false story about Don Jr.'s Trump Tower meeting with Russians. Trump publicly praised her departure, but privately began downgrading her importance, suspecting she might be talking to investigators. In Trump's world, loyalty only flows one direction, and even that has limits when legal jeopardy looms. Steve Bannon operated from his cramped embassy townhouse, part frat house, part command center. Though officially banished, he and Trump remained obsessed with each other. Bannon had installed allies in key positions, Pompeo, Bolton, Kudlow, yet he stayed realistic. Dude, he's Donald fucking Trump. When Congress passed a $1.3 trillion bill with only $1.6 billion for border security, Trump initially told Kushner they'd gotten the wall, totally. Bannon immediately alerted Trump's base to light him up. Fox News hosts hammered the betrayal message. By Friday morning, Trump reversed position in such violent rage that his hair came undone, momentarily revealing an almost entirely bald Donald Trump. Despite threatening to veto, he eventually caved after Mattis warned soldiers wouldn't be paid. He vowed never, never, never again, pounding the desk with each word. Bannon understood something crucial. Trump was moved not by details, but by the fear of losing.
Don McGahn, White House counsel with no prior White House experience, endured Trump's constant rage about the Justice Department personally hounding him. "It's my Justice Department," Trump insisted. McGahn would mutter, "This is why we can't have nice things," under his breath. Trump couldn't grasp the DOJ's post-Watergate independence. Having spent his career heading a small family operation, he believed the DOJ and FBI worked directly for him. When lectured about DOJ's custom and tradition, Trump responded, "I don't want to hear this bullshit." Trump desperately wanted a killer lawyer, not from a major firm, but a theatrical fighter who could perform on television. He became obsessed with Stormy Daniels' attorney, Michael Avenatti. "He's a star," Trump declared. "Get me a star." Enter Rudy Giuliani, delivering rambling performances that horrified Bannon and bewildered even Trump. Yet Giuliani's strategy worked, contrasting the silent Mueller with unpredictable, theatrical defense. When Giuliani publicly announced the special counsel wouldn't indict Trump, it forced Mueller into a corner, either break his silence or let the claim stand. Trump ran his business like a criminal enterprise, romanticizing mobster life and deliberately rejecting respectability in favor of the dapper Don persona from his New York nightlife days with Roy Cohn. Michael Cohen joined this circle in 2006, an ambitious Long Island lawyer who embraced a mobster persona to please Trump, becoming his literal bagman, handling cash for women and off-the-books issues. After the FBI raided Cohen's office, Trump remained oddly sanguine, repeatedly stating, "I have deniability." But tensions mounted when Cohen began appearing regularly at a Manhattan cafe, smoking cigars for paparazzi, sending a message that he expected legal bills paid and possibly a pardon. Rather than understanding the threat, Trump became obsessed with Cohen stealing the limelight and his daughter's Instagram posts showing expensive trips, publicly belittling him instead of protecting their mutual interests. Bannon remained astonished by Trump's ability to lie with complete sang-froid, making direct eye contact while fabricating stories that never wavered. Trump's compulsive lying alarmed aides, but demonstrated his unique strength. Lying without shame or fear of consequences became a powerful tool because somebody always believes you. This shamelessness would carry him through the Helsinki disaster and into the midterms. Trump arrived in Brussels for the NATO summit sleepless and disheveled, immediately accusing Germany of being totally controlled by Russia. He told aides, "NATO bores the shit out of me," viewing its bureaucracy as designed to exploit his short attention span. His UK visit proved catastrophic. Greeted by protests and a giant baby balloon, he undermined Theresa May's Brexit strategy while praising her rival. In Helsinki, Putin kept Trump waiting nearly an hour. Afterward, Trump emerged looking like a beaten dog, appearing servile while incoherently exonerating Putin, who had casually dismissed Trump as a nobody during his 2013 Moscow visit. With Republicans coming unglued, Ivanka and Scaramucci convinced Trump to blame misspeaking, leading to his infamous "would-wouldn't" explanation. During these televised remarks, the lights mysteriously went out. Bannon was incredulous. When Ivanka and the mooch can talk the commander-in-chief into thinking that people will believe you had a double negative problem, you've left the Cartesian universe. With 100 days until midterms, Republican prospects looked grim. Bannon recognized Trump needed an exogenous event to fire up his base. A caravan of Honduran migrants heading north provided Fox News with alarming visuals. Trump seized on the issue with threatening tweets. On election night, rural white voters remained loyal, while urban and suburban voters expelled even moderate Republicans. Though Republicans gained Senate seats, the House loss was devastating. Bannon's grim conclusion? It would be a 2-year presidency. As the shutdown dragged into January, Jared and Ivanka recast Trump's Oval Office address, replacing "national emergency" with "humanitarian crisis." Trump delivered a nothing burger, appearing small, constrained, trapped. After 35 days, the longest shutdown in American history, Trump capitulated. His credibility was shattered. Intelligence chiefs publicly contradicted his threat assessments. Senate Republicans opposed his Syria withdrawal. Federal prosecutors expanded investigations into his inaugural committee and business dealings. On February 14th, Trump declared his national emergency. The wall he'd promised remained largely unbuilt, a perfect metaphor for promises that couldn't withstand reality's relentless pressure. Mueller delivered his report on March 22nd with no new indictments. Attorney General Barr's summary stated, "Mueller found no evidence of conspiracy with Russia." Trump proclaimed complete and total exoneration, celebrating, "Who's the man? I'm the man." Yet even in victory, he remained paranoid, repeatedly asking, "Am I safe?" while acknowledging, "They are going to keep coming after me." The siege wasn't a single dramatic assault, but a slow constriction. Allies departing, investigations expanding, credibility eroding. Trump survived through sheer shamelessness and an unshakable base, ending his second year as he began, embattled, defiant, surrounded by lawyers instead of advisors. Trump's survival reveals an uncomfortable truth. In our polarized era, accountability depends less on facts than on whether your supporters care about them. The walls closed in, but never quite crushed him. In a system designed for truth to matter, what happens when half the country decides it doesn't? That may be the real siege, not against Trump, but against the shared reality democracy requires to function.